Stop Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, for this episode 45. This should be interesting. I'm going to talk about the movie Passengers, starring Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. It just premiered this Wednesday, December 21st, and the reviews and responses so far to this movie have been surprising and very, very interesting. Based on the premise and the stars and everything I've seen in the teasers and trailers and previews and everything, to see all that and then see the movie myself and then see the response. I mean, this is really a very, this is really quite something. So let's get into it. All right, so first off, the usual disclaimer. I am going to review the whole movie. It'll be spoiled. If you have not seen the movie, stop this podcast, go out and see the movie, and then come back and listen. So you have 3 seconds. 3, 2, 1. All right. So let's get into it. The movie, Passengers. It's a science fiction. I mean, from the trailer. Let's do it this way. Let's start with the trailers and the premise and the synopsis of everything we read on the internet said about the movie Passengers. And this is the way they presented the movie. There's a ark ship heading from Earth to a new planet. It's a very long voyage. Everyone's in stasis. So it's one of these generational ships, in that everyone's asleep. And so they will be on the ship in stasis for a century, wake up, and will not have aged. So the ship is automated. There's no living crew. Everyone's asleep, the crew, the passengers, everyone. And they're going into this new terraformed planet, which apparently looks like Yellowstone National Park. Very beautiful. You know, maybe that's just the advertising, but whatever. Something goes wrong, and Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence are woken up early, way early, 90 years, and they don't know how to go back to sleep, and they have to find a way to make do. And as time goes on, they begin to see that there's something wrong with the ship, and that malfunction threatens everyone, and it also partially explains why they were awoken early. And that's the impression you're given, and then they have to find a way to repair the ship. So that's what the idea that we got from the trailer and from everything. In reality, only Chris Pratt is woken up by the malfunction. And after a year on his own, he is so lonely and desperate and everything, he sees Jennifer Lawrence's character, Aurora Lane, in stasis and just falls in love with her. And he decides to wake her up so he is not alone. So the two of them are on a ship, but only one of them is there by malfunction. The other one is there because Chris Pratt let her go. That is an entirely different situation for a lot of people. That is not a science fiction, like, story, like a typical space opera kind of space travel, you know, kind of human drama in exploration. This is a moral dilemma that's presented and a moral failing on the part of Chris Pratt for basically waking a woman up 90 years early, basically giving her a death sentence to die on the ship rather than reach the new world. It's tantamount to murder because in her experience and in her life, her lifetime, by the way these hibernation things work, she goes to sleep, she wakes up 120 years later, having not aged a day, and is able to live on the new planet and live a full life if she so chooses, or if she chooses to come back or go to another planet, whatever. By waking her up in the middle of the transit, she's going to die on the ship instead of reaching the planet and living a full life. And she's going to live on a ship that... it's big, but she's alone, aside from Chris Pratt's character, or Jim Preston is the name of the character. So it is, in a way, murder. But of course, legally, of course, under our current, you know, laws, it's not murder. He would not be convicted, but of course, in the future, something like that would have to be contemplated as soon as the hibernation technology was mastered. So there's that. But obviously, this kind of thing is a serious crime. It is, I would imagine, to be treated almost as a capital crime. So that is the premise of Passengers. Not two innocent people woke up because of a malfunction and have to find a way to save the ship and their own lives. That two entirely different stories, two entirely different premises. That twist changes everything for a lot of people that went to see this movie. And I can see in the reviews and I can see in the responses that this, the way that Jennifer Lawrence is awakened just changes it. The other thing that a lot of critics said this, and I agree entirely, is that this seems to try to be two or three different movies. And I agree. I'll get into the premise and the moral dilemma being presented and the kind of thing that happened later. But the other thing is how this unique premise, this kind of twisted premise from what we were expecting, is unfolded. So let's go through the three acts of the movie, because this is a three-act system like every other movie. Act one, Jim Preston wakes up on the ship by himself, doesn't know how to go back to sleep, and doesn't know how to wake anyone else up. So he's by himself on the ship, which is designed to be kind of a leisure ship for people because it's supposed to wake everyone up 4 months before they arrive so that they have 4 months of leisure. But since he's the only one there, it has this ability to keep repairing itself and regenerating. It actually has a, how do you say this? Basically, he can live in leisure on this ship for his entire life. I mean, that's kind of what is conveyed. That's act one. That is like a sci-fi, that is a pure science fiction story from like a classical story of space travel by yourself, the kind of being in the vast expanse of space, being on a ship by yourself, sterile, and facing, you know, the possibility of just dying on the ship before you reach your destination. Actually, that is the premise of a short story by a good friend of mine, Retzi Bruno. The name of the short story is This Long Vigil. It's available at Amazon.com. And the first, and I bring it up because it's a similar premise. It's similar, not identical, but it's a very similar premise to Act 1 of Passengers. And I thought that was interesting. But anyway, that's Act 1. Act 2 basically begins when he wakes up Aurora Lane. And the two of them start, you know, develop a romance and things like that. So they develop a relationship, and now he's not alone. Now he's happy. He has a woman with him, and she's upset, goes through the grieving process of realizing she's going to die on the ship, and kind of makes peace with it by building a kind of a relationship and a life with Jim. That's act two. That is more of the traditional romantic, but it's a very twisted romantic story because of how she got there. And if you were to take the science fiction element out of it, Act 2 really, it's not a romantic comedy, because this movie has funny moments, but it's not a comedy. And it's not a romantic comedy. A few reviewers said that, and I think they maybe need to kind of rethink what a romantic comedy is before they say that. But basically, this is kind of like a man kidnaps a woman, brings him down to a doomsday bunker and tells her the whole world ended and it's just the two of them and they're just going to have to make do until the fallout comes out. Now, in that scenario, that's kidnapping and that's false imprisonment, and, you know, basically everything he does after that can be construed as assault, rape, whatever. I mean, basically everything that happens to her and happens in that bunker is all under false pretenses, and is serious crimes, get you in prison for a long time. That is not really that different than what Jim's character does here. So that's Act 2. And what Act 2 is trying to show is that he's doing this because he's so painfully lonely. He's in love with this sleeping beauty, Aurora Lane, because she's asleep when he discovers her in her pod. And then he starts looking up information on her, starts reading her kind of her files on, because every passenger on the ship kind of does records a message on why they're going to the new world and, you know, what they do, who they are, kind of like this little intro, you know, getting to know your fellow colonists, you know, thing like that. So he falls in love with her, and that's how that all happens. But that's really it's hard to look at their romance in any clear way because of the way it started and the way he's not creepy about it. He asks her out on a date in a boyish, you know, kind of clever, you know, romantic, you know, kind of sweet boyish fashion. Everything about it is consensual. If you take away the reason they're together. So I think what they're trying to do in Act 2 is make it kind of make you kind of fall in love with them, with their connection, their relationship, and that's what they're trying to do in Act 2. And you kind of do, because Chris Pratt's a charming guy, good looking guy. Jennifer Lawrence is one of the best actresses of our generation. And the two of them have some pretty decent chemistry, and they carry Act 2. But it's hard to get past the reason they're together. Act 3 is a sci-fi action survival story. As the ship's falling apart, they got to find a way to fix it, and they have to work together, and all the previous the crime of Jim Preston is set aside, and all their drama of the first two acts are completely thrown out for a basically we need to repair the ship or we're all going to die kind of situation. And then the conclusion of the movie is by a consensus, and I agree, a bad ending. It is terrible and totally unsatisfying and just makes you wonder what the writers were thinking, why they thought that would land. So if you look at the movie individually as three acts, you have like a very cold intellectual sci-fi drama in Act 1. You have kind of a romantic movie in Act 2. And then you have a sci-fi action survival space action movie, space opera maybe even in Act 3. Three different kinds of movies in three different acts. By themselves, they're great premises for movies, but clushed together, this is a kind of Frankenstein-esque kind of movie as a result. And that is the reason that I think a large number of critics have given this a negative review, in addition to the moral ambiguity of the lead character. I'll get into that in a second here. But those are the two reasons. One, it's basically trying to be three different movies at three different times. It does not work together. They don't clash together, and it kind of they undermine one another, each act of this movie, and also the moral quandary. So those are the two biggest objections. I agree with both entirely. Moving along, let's get to the moral dilemma. And it's the moral dilemma is what happens when Chris Pratt is standing in front of the character's name is Jim Preston. But Jim Preston is standing in front of the pod for Aurora Lane. She's laying there unconscious and in a sleep. And he's just smitten with her. And he knows what it means if he wakes her up. But he is so painfully lonely. He's been alone for a year. He's contemplating suicide. But like he sees her and his thoughts of suicide go away. And he starts just going back and forth in his head. He's so lonely. Like, should I do it? Well, if I do it, it's horrible. It's unforgivable. But if I don't do it, I'm going to die alone, and I'm not, I just can't kill myself. So that's the thing. And he ends up making, obviously, the choice to wake her up. And you see you expect to see some kind of regret, guilt, feelings like that on the surface. And you get a little bit of that after he's done it, but not nearly enough. He really is so happy to have someone else on the ship with him that he just is super helpful and wants to help her get through the process of accepting what's happened and yada, yada, yada. So you don't really get the guilt. And, as their kind of relationship starts to develop, their friendship and then a romantic connection, like he just dives full in and just you don't see any regret or guilt after that until she finds out. I don't think, the movie tried to get you past that by showing their chemistry and their connection, but it's pretty clear you just can't get past what he did. This is false imprisonment, essentially, and a form of murder. That's what it is. There's a clear argument to be made. This is a capital crime. I mean, that's really what we're seeing here, and that everything that happens therefrom to her and to him and to anything else is just after the fact, crimes after the fact. We can't get around that. So that's not to say that this movie's a terrible idea, or that premise is a terrible idea, or this would never happen, or this whole thing's sick and twisted and outrageous, or maybe it is sick and twisted. But actually, that by itself is actually a very fascinating premise to a movie. It's dark, it's twisted, and it's kind of a glimpse into the human need for connection and for companionship, but of course, in this case, he's in love with her, and so it's very easy to say, well, he just, he's horny, or, he sees a beautiful woman, and he has an opportunity to keep her around and use this lie to keep her around, and it's kind of this, it's a little bit of a twisted thing, so it doesn't really execute very well, but the premise of him being so painfully lonely that he is willing to do this to another human being, keep it a secret, just to have somebody to spend the rest of his life with on this ship, it's a dark thing to do, And it would have been fascinating if they would have explored the guilt, the regret, the kind of back and forth, the consequences of that choice, and really the victim of the choice realizing the truth, coming to grips with it, and what happens with that. And really, that would have been a very, very cool story. It would have been dark, twisted, not the typical happy ending romance. I mean, the whole romantic thing would have to be completely discarded. Otherwise, this doesn't work. They didn't discard it. In fact, they found a way to make it all work out in the end. And I think that was their that was the huge mistake right there. If they would have thrown that out and just stuck with the moral dilemma of Jim Preston's decision of being alone or waking somebody up to be with him, that's actually a very interesting premise and story. And that could have worked. But they didn't. After that happens, they treat it as it just, you know, like he's like this love-struck boy, and he just couldn't help himself because he was so in love with her. Like, that doesn't work. I mean, this is a false imprisonment scenario. That was my reaction to the overall moral dilemma and the ending. The way they kind of twist it around so that she ends up forgiving him in a very strange way, or that his crime actually is, after the fact, not really a crime, but actually might have saved her life in the end. That was all kind of like, oh, well, it all worked out in the end for him, you know, for him, key, because he doesn't really have to take full responsibility for what he did, because he actually, in a way, indirect way, saved her life, because the ship was about to blow up, and she played a key, pivotal role in saving the ship, and so if she had not been awakened, the ship would have blown up, and she would have died anyway. So that, I mean, that's kind of a twisted way of saying, oh, well, you know, he actually, in the end, made the right choice. It's just all, you know, it all worked out in the end. And I mean, I'm sure that bothered quite a few critics, I noticed, and it did bother me. I thought the ending was pretty it was a little messed up and really did not satisfy me at all. The regret, the guilt, you know, of what he did is just completely discarded by basically creating a scenario where she has to forgive him in order to survive, you know. And it's just, but even if they do work together to save the ship and survive, like, can she still forgive him? You know, he didn't know that the ship was falling apart and was going to be destroyed and that she would be important to saving the ship and saving all their lives. He didn't know that. He was just lonely. So, it was just, no, that doesn't make up. So we have a moral dilemma that's not explored. In fact, it's excused in a very bad way. In the third act, and then the ending is just, it's underwhelming. So I think that's where this movie failed. It didn't explore the moral dilemma. It abandoned it, and then it excused it. It used basically a deus ex machina situation to excuse or mitigate what Chris Pratt did. And just, you know, I can just imagine, you know, if he was just some jerk, you know, at the end of the movie, be, you know, she's all upset, you know, that you woke me up, you've ruined my life, and then like all the ship malfunctioned and everything happens. He's like, see, it all worked out in the end, babe. I don't know what you're complaining about. I actually saved your life. You know, I mean, that's just such a jerky, just shitty, like, that's not even ends justify the means. Because the ends weren't on, all right, I guess I'm going on and on. But basically, bad ending, the movie abandons a very fascinating moral dilemma premise. Moving along. I haven't seen these written about too much so far, but when I walked out of the movie, I had some problems with the plot, aside from Jim Preston's basic attempted murder and false imprisonment of Aurora Lane. The plot has numerous instances, like Deus Ex Machina instances in this movie. The ship's design and the computer's design seem to be set so that this story works. And let me go through a few of them. And they don't make sense. This is why I call it Deus Ex Machina, not just bad world building or shoddy world. Basically, this ship and the systems and everything designed and the overall thing is designed in a weird way, in a distorted way, that is not very plausible, in my opinion, just so that this movie can work. And I think that's basically somebody writing a normal movie in a sci-fi setting who doesn't know what they're doing. They're trying to That, and I feel like that's what happened here, because I know the writer, John Spates, is a science fiction writer. He wrote the screenplay for Doctor Strange and Prometheus. Neither of those movies really blew me away. In fact, Prometheus was a big disappointment. But I feel like they alter the technology to suit the story, and they don't really care if it makes sense or not. So here's a few. Number one, the crew pods are protected behind a firewall, and there's no way to get in there to the crew pods to wake up the crew to let them know there's something wrong with the ship. Why? This is a civilian cruiser, and basically a luxury liner. Why would crew pods be protected like that? And Jim spends months trying to get through the door, and he can't get through the door. So this thing is basically protected from everything on the ship. There's no way to get in there. No way at all. All right, I understand protecting pods in general, passengers, crew, whatever, from problems. But making the crew pod section of the ship impenetrable, that doesn't make any fucking sense. There should have been, nothing's impenetrable. I mean, it was just bizarre to me that he spends all... And then they all sit there and they're like, oh, I tried that. There's explosives. He has all these tools. You know, he has everything to work with to get through that door. Why would you make the door that strong? I mean, it's like they designed it so that nobody could get in who was trying. This isn't a military vessel. This is a cruiser. And if it's an explosion they're protecting the crew from, why don't they use those walls throughout the whole ship? Because clearly they didn't, because the asteroid flew right through the fucking ship. But anyway. All right, so crew pods are quarantined in this fireproof bunker of section of the ship that is impenetrable. Doesn't make sense. One, all right, that's number one. Two, the computer in the very beginning of the movie, the computer knows there's something wrong. It's showing it. It has a diagnostic system that's working. It's running diagnostics. It knows something is wrong. And then there's one problem that it's unable to self-repair. What does it do? Nothing. This is an AI designed to self-repair and to diagnose, and it knows there is a problem with its core. It shows as much. And these problems get worse and worse and worse, and these malfunctions hit a point where even the self-diagnostic systems break down. But we know the problem. An asteroid went through the computer and the engine core. If the computer cannot detect that in its diagnostic system and does not think to, I don't know, wake somebody up, or do something about it, or have red lights flashing left and right about it, what is it there for? Why does it think nothing is wrong? And why does it think it's okay to wake up one passenger? I mean, this thing has the AI capability to basically fly itself, you know, 200 light years or whatever it is, and yet when it sees that there's a problem with itself, it doesn't do anything about it. And we're expected to believe that an asteroid shooting through the computer core is the reason it doesn't. Like, it's just malfunction after malfunction. Doing that kind of physical damage to computers and to computer hardware doesn't really yield things like that. And usually the problems, when you do physical damage, you don't get kind of quirks in the programming. And that's what this movie shows. Quirks in the programming. And then it tries to fix itself. And then it can't fix itself. And then things just spiral out of control. I mean, it's just a whatever. Number three. The pods are fail-proof. They can't fail. They can't malfunction. There's nothing in sophisticated technology I have ever heard or ever read of anything of that nature that would ever claim to be fail-proof and therefore have no repair, maintenance, alarms, alerts, or any kind of system or backup. These things don't have backups. Everything on this ship seems to have some sort of backup, although not everything. The pods don't. Number three, I don't know where I am. Anyway, the next one, just when the plot needs it, the ship wakes up Lawrence Fishburne. But he's a crew member, and they start going into all the rooms and all the places of the ship they couldn't get into before, and they start realizing the gravity of the problem. But of course, Lawrence Fishburne can't fix it. They have to fix it because he is fatally ill because of how he was woken up. So he wakes up enough time to give them access to the broader sense of the ship, show them what's going on, show them that their ship's about to die, and then he dies. That's a deus ex machina. They needed something to advance the plot, so they woke up a character, played by Lawrence Fishburne, and advanced the plot, and then he conveniently dies. For the sake of the plot, that's convenient. For the sake of, you know, the characters, it's not convenient, but, I mean, for the plot, it definitely is. Because if he was alive throughout the whole thing, he would have fixed the ship. He would have repaired it, because he knew what he was doing, but that would have been too easy. Next deus ex machina moment. Jim Preston miraculously survives his battle with the core being exposed, you know, kind of excreted out of that hole out into space in order to shut the core down and cool it off. He uses a door that he rips off a cabinet in one of the rooms as his blast shield, and it doesn't cover his own body, and yet miraculously that blast shield protects him from the engine core, which is shooting the ship to half the speed of light, basically. His suit, which is basically a recreational suit for tourists to go outside, that's what it's there for. It's not there for the crew, it's there for the passengers, survives it. Well, barely survives it. Just enough for him to, you know, be alive for a little while and give Jennifer Lawrence time to get him. That doesn't make any fucking sense. If that's an engine core being expelled out of a narrow tunnel, and that amount of heat, everything on him, no cabinet, metal cabinet drawer is going to protect him. And if it is, then it's not really what, you know, that's not what they showed it as. They showed it as basically a big heavy metal door on a cabinet that's in one of the rooms. It's not really something that you would think was designed to withstand an enormous amount of heat. That's just not what they showed it to be. If it is, then they probably should have shown him getting that door somewhere else. Autodoc. It is said in the movie that there are no backup hibernation pods. Why? They have backup, and he actually says this. Jim Preston actually says this. They have backup parts for every part of the ship except for hibernation pods because they're fail-proof. That's got to be one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. We have spare parts for everything on the ship except for the thing that is the most vital to the human inhabitants of the ship. Oh, but then they find out the autodock, which is an infirmary device, can put you to sleep and act as a hibernation cell. But there's only one. And they have backup parts for every piece of the ship, but they don't have backup parts for the autodock. So they can't get a second autodock up there so they can both go to sleep and reach the new planet, which is called Homestead 2. Dumbass name for planet. There's only one. Why is there only one? No explanation. The only things in the ship where there's only one of them, or there's no backup parts or backup replacement parts, are the hibernation pods and the autodock pods. Of all the things on a ship that you would think you would need backup parts for that are vital, you know, things that you would really want to replace if something went wrong, the pods would be one of them. But no, they don't do that. Another deus ex machina moment is when Aurora Lane finds out that Jim awoke her and that she was not awoken by accident and by mistake or malfunction. She says that there's no secrets between me and Jim, and then he goes to use the bathroom. And you see this kind of hesitation or moment on Arthur's face, the character, the droid character. He's the bartender. He sees that, and he knows that Jim woke her up, but Jim told him to keep it a secret. Well, she said, oh, there's no secrets between us, and you see this look on Arthur's face. And as soon as Jim goes to the bathroom, Arthur lets loose the secret. It's as if the look on his face, it's like he was human, and he knew that, well, if there's no secrets between them, she needs to know this. Like, that he took that literally. I mean, it was really it's almost like as a machine, he decided to do it. Like, he consciously decided to do it, even though he's just a bartender robot droid. It was just, the other interpretation is that she says there's no secrets between us, and so her saying that negates his command to him to keep it a secret. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, he's a bartender. Keep a secret, don't keep a secret, don't say anything. Like, why, how much program do you want to give this bartender? Like, and why does he just accept one command, two commands, whatever. Like, why does one override the other? Why say anything at all? She doesn't even ask. He volunteers it. He volunteers that he was so excited up to meet her. So it's like he consciously chose to break the secret. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a slip up in programming or code. It was stupid. It was a stupid little moment, but they needed to find a way to let Jennifer Lawrence, to let Aurora know that she was woken up and that it wasn't a malfunction. It was a very shitty way to do it, in my opinion, and I think it took away... I just think plausibility was really stretched in this movie in terms of all the Deus Ex Machina moments where the machines malfunction or the design of the ship is made in such a way to help the plot along. Because otherwise, if things were designed on the ship the way, you know, in other science fiction movies or just common sense, this movie can't work. The whole premise just can't work. So they basically redesigned everything in this ship in ways that were incoherent and illogical in order to allow this plot to succeed. It was lazy, in my opinion. Somebody should have read this and told them that this... If you want to make a romance movie, fine, make a romance movie. But if you want to make a science fiction or a space opera, this is not going to fly. And it's not going to work. Apparently nobody told him that. All right. I noticed that out of the critics I read, that the overwhelming majority of critics that gave this movie a better than passing grade or, you know, at least a reasonable score and didn't think it was, you know, just junk, were mostly men. Virtually no female critics like this movie. I did find one or two or three, so I mean it's not unanimous, but and a lot of them talked about the kind of sexist undertones of this movie. And we've already talked about a few of them already, you know, the base, you know, the foundation of the relationship, and you know, so this really cannot be looked at as a romantic movie because it's basically built on false imprisonment. So it's kind of a, when it's built on that, you can't look at it as a romantic story. It's not a romance. It's not a consensual, even kind of chemistry-built thing. It's basically contrived on the part of the guy who lied to her for a long period of time and basically did something that's tantamount to murder. But I don't know if it ends there, because, I mean, it's kind of... And then one person mentions, like this is a love story built on Stockholm Syndrome. That's what this movie comes off as. Because of the way, but to me, if they would have not focused on the love story and had it conclude with a happy ending to their love, that this movie could have worked if that was not the ending. If they would have altered the ending, and this would have been about guilt, forgiveness, about, you know, if she could forgive them, although most of us would probably agree she probably shouldn't have been able to. I mean, it'd be hard to. But I mean, the struggle of... his struggle of doing this to somebody. But of course, his struggle of, you don't see, his struggle seems to end the moment that she's awake and they start talking to each other. After that, he just wants to make this relationship work. So that doesn't work. So it would have been, it really would not have, it couldn't work if you focused on Aurora's, you know, journey to forgiving him for what he did. I think that's just too creepy, and I just don't think that works. I think in the end, that couldn't have gone that way. I think he probably would have been better, and it probably would have been more in the sense of kind of a classic, maybe even Shakespearean story, that after awaking her, the guilt and the guilt of what he did makes it impossible for him to have a relationship with her. That even though he's in love with her, he cannot bring himself to actually, whatever you want to say, consummate it, close it, get married. I mean, and he ends up rejecting her because he can't live with the fact. I mean, that would have been the thing, that, you know, the date and everything, like he thinks it's going well, but when it's time for them to, you know, the first kiss or whatever, he can't do it because he knows why they're there. He knows why, how, what this is all built on. The movie didn't go in that direction. The movie, instead, he just dives right in and wants to forget about why she's there. He never articulates very much his feelings of the why and his guilt or anything else. He kind of stands there and stares at her and then kind of looks at the ground like, I'm sorry. And then he gives that little speech over the intercom, which is just very, very underwhelming. I mean, she's listening to it, and then she screams at the PA, you know, "I don't care." And everyone in the audience where I was at was like, "No shit, you know, like, what made you think that that little kind of plea over a PA would make any difference?" It was ridiculous. Again, well, we didn't go that way. But is it sexist, or is it kind of weird in that sense? And the answer, I don't know. Everyone seems to have their own opinion. The majority seems to think that this was kind of a very kind of sick or demented or twisted relationship built on false imprisonment, you know, maybe Stockholm syndrome, maybe, you know, in a certain definitions, maybe a form of sexual assault. Although, if you watch the movie, it's very, very difficult. But, I mean, it's just depending on your definition of consent and what role lies and deception play in obtaining consent, and whether, you know, you view lies and things. Anyway, but I did notice another thing. One, Jim's just forgiven. There's no discussion. There's no real interchange. She just forgives him because it's like she needs to in order to save the ship. And she doesn't want to be on the ship alone without him. Of course, the reason she would be on the ship... let me back up. The moment is when he has to hold the door open for the core to expel it, the heat, the excess heat, and expel itself out into space. He has to sit there and hold the door open, which means he's probably going to die. And she says, "Don't do it. There has to be another way. I can't live on this ship alone without you, or live on the ship without you." And this needs to be like this plea, like she doesn't want to be alone either, you know, that even though she hates him and hates what he did, she can't stand to live without him, yada, yada, yada. The problem is that the reason that she would be stuck on that ship alone by herself after this, you know, selfless deed of his is because he woke her up. So it's not really a selfless deed. Actually, he's doing what he ought to do. Actually, it's not even enough because she's still going to die before they reach the planet. So there's no real forgiveness. There's no real kind of closing of the moral loop at all. She just forgives him. And then they're back to kissing again and building their own little kind of environmental green utopia in the lobby of the ship or whatever. I don't know. I did notice that Jennifer Lawrence is wearing skin-tight outfits or slinky dresses through about two-thirds of this movie. There is a scene where she needs to pull the manual release, but it's too hot, so she has to take off her shirt in order to, you know, wrap it around the release in order to pull it. It's the same trick they used with Natalie Portman in Star Wars Attack of the Clones. The animal, the little monster that's after her kind of scrapes across her shirt and rips like the midriff of her shirt open. It's just kind of like one of these, you know, let's create an action situation where like part of her clothing has to be removed, but it's not in a, you know, a guy removing the clothing or some sort of love act. It's more like, no, let's create a situation where some of her clothing comes off. Like maybe it lights on fire. Maybe it gets ripped off by a monster. Or in this case, she has to take her shirt off and use it as a, use it to wrap it around this super hot lever that she needs to pull to save the ship. I mean, there's a scene, you've seen it in the trailer where the gravity's turned off while she's swimming. So we have to see her in mortal danger in a skimpy bathing suit. I mean, things like that that are titillating and meant to keep your attention. And there is some semi-nudity in this movie as well, both ways, men and, you know, Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. Those things were clearly, I mean, you combine that with the kind of false imprisonment, you know, kind of basis of the relationship and why the two of them are together. I mean, it does get, I can definitely see how somebody could watch this and just think, this is getting creepier and creepier. This is not romantic. This is not heartwarming. This is just weird. And I think that is why a lot of, and it looks so far in the movie, in the review so far, a lot of people are turned off by this. And a lot of people are rejecting this movie, giving it horrible reviews and saying that it doesn't matter how beautiful the special effects are, the 3D, the ship, you know, the stars and all these little moments they have in the movie of you know, traveling through space and that doesn't save it, because other movies have done that, and there's other space operas out there. There's other space travel movies out there about maybe not on this quite on this premise, but visually there's other movies like this. So that's just not enough to save it. And as the consensus on Rotten Tomatoes says, the kind of appeal and chemistry of Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence also does not save this movie. And I agree entirely that even though they are cute together, that's just not enough to save this movie. And they, I mean, both of them are pretty good actors. Jennifer Lawrence, of course, is very talented. Not enough to save the movie. So I think that covers just about everything I have to say about the movie. Obviously, you can tell I am just not a fan of it. I think it failed. It had an opportunity. I think the premise, and there was something here to work with to make it a special movie, and they just decided not to explore it, and they decided to do two or three things at once, and they failed at all two or three. And that is why this movie, for me at least, gets below 3 stars. I guess I would just give it 2 stars. And I think it's forgettable and not really worth mentioning as one of the big movies of the year. I think it will bomb in the end. I don't know how much money it costs to make, but I just don't see this movie really reaching $300 million. I think it might, maybe it'll break even worldwide, but I really think that the expectations for a movie like this were pretty high because of the star power, the special effects, and the kind of cool little premise they thought they had. But in the end, I just don't think this movie makes, I don't think this movie makes $200 million, to tell you the truth. And I think combined, it'll be, you know, with foreign sales, I think this thing will barely pay for itself. And I think the reviews and the critics once it goes to streaming, I don't think a lot of people are going to stream this movie. I don't think anyone's going to buy it. I think this is a waste. This movie's a waste. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne, Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence. I mean, Andy Garcia actually has a scene in this movie for all of 5 seconds. Why? I don't know. 5 seconds and he doesn't have a single line. But hey, he's in the movie. I just don't know why. And really, the final scenes in the movie don't make any sense. I don't know why they thought they would work. It didn't have, the final scene just did not have any connection to the rest of the movie. It just didn't make any damn sense. And Jennifer Lawrence's voiceover of it, of the message, I mean, it just, they really did not, this ending is an awful ending. It's just an overall awful ending. The last 15 to 20 minutes of this movie are bad. So that is my take on the movie. It will not be, I think I'm going to go see Assassin's Creed. And that will be the last movie I will watch. There's a couple movies on science fiction or on Microsoft On Demand I want to see. So maybe if I watch one of them might be like a contender for movie of the year in my mind. But I think as of today, December 21st, and you know there's a couple movies left for me to see, but I'm not really optimistic. So as of today, I would have to say the sci-fi movie of the year is Arrival. And Arrival to me is not really a classic game-changing movie. It's 4 to 4.5, 4 stars in my opinion. It was a good movie, and I recommend it for science fiction fans. And go check out the podcast where I review it and go through it after you've seen the movie. And it's a good one. And I think as of now, Arrival is the movie of the year for science fiction. And I think this was a very bad off year for sci-fi. Just a lot of mediocrity and some things that turned out to be total junk. And of course, Marvel and DC produced their usual, you know, cash cows, but none of them really are great movies. They're just not this year. And I think, we could throw in Deadpool. Deadpool's a great movie, but I don't think that's what people think I mean when I say science fiction movie of the year, because Deadpool is a comedy with mostly fantasy based undertones. So, but Deadpool is an awesome movie. It's hysterical. It's the role Ryan Reynolds was born to play. Great movie. I don't think it fits this category quite, but I guess maybe if I wanted to expand my kind of range and field of movies of what I would consider for movies of the year, and I did include Deadpool, I think Deadpool and Arrival are probably the two best movies of the year. And that's just where I am right now. Maybe we'll see 10 days from now if I feel the same way. So I think that will do it. I do not think I will have another podcast. It is the holidays. I'm traveling. I'm very busy for the next week or so. So I don't think I'm going to do another one for at least another 10 to 12 days. So I think this is the last one of the year 2016. Unfortunately, a down year for movies, but a couple great stuff on television. A lot of great things going on in science fiction on television. A few great books. So, you know, not all is lost in 2016, but That I'll have to sign off there, and I'm not sure what the next one will be on. It might be on. I don't think I'm going to do one on Assassin's Creed. I don't have enough time, and I'll be traveling. So I guess until number 46, we'll just have to wait and see what the topic will be on that. So I will sign off there, and thank you all for listening, and until next time.